I'm Fred Cohen, and we have a little bit more than 250 slides to cover today, which means we're going to be moving along at a relatively rapid pace. See if this all works right. Well, maybe not. There we go. Going to just sort of get you started over the next couple of minutes. We're going to talk a little bit about the properties of the things, the classes of attacks and defense, if you want to call them that, I'm going to be speaking about today. Talk about attacks all morning. Somewhere around lunch we'll finish with the attacks, and then all afternoon we're going to be spending on defenses. There are more defenses than there are attacks. I think that's probably a good thing, but that's maybe a matter of opinion. We're not going to talk very much about threats, although we probably represent a substantial part of the threat profile here today, and a little bit about analysis at the end. So the purpose of this class is to give comprehensive coverage of most of what anybody knows about in terms of attacks and defenses, and I use those terms fairly loosely, and I'll be a little bit tighter later on. Basically, we want to know what people can do to systems and people, and when I say information systems, that includes people, hardware, software, telecommunications, networking, mental processes, please come in, and any and everything else related thereto. And then how do you defend those systems? And the method of presentation for today is enumeration. We're going to go through, I guess it's 94 types of attacks and 140 types of defenses. And we're going to provide examples in as many cases as possible. One of the things I want to do to keep you awake, because frankly you would go to sleep very quickly, is to have each of you think about examples on your own. And after I run through our examples, you call out a couple examples. And then we'll move on to the next one because time is of the essence. And this class is a result of about 20 years of collecting data on information security online. And I guess I started earlier than most in collecting it. We created InfoSec Heaven after a point, which was at all.net, a website which had lots of stuff on attacks and defenses. Eventually wrote a book on the subject, Protection and Security on the Information Superhighway. We started to build a comprehensive InfoSurity database. And this is now a fairly substantial funded effort. Among other things, we're automating certain kind of risk management decisions, automating certain kinds of analytical capabilities for indications and warning, and lots of other stuff like that. And maybe the most interesting aspect is that we're starting, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, to scan in all the source documents. That is, whenever we have a citation, and you'll get a piece of paper with all the citations from today's course at the end of the day, because they're still copying it. Whenever we have a citation in the database, what we're trying to do is scan in the citation, OCR it, and have the original. Now this brings up copyright issues, so we have to restrict access to all the source material unless people have purchased copyrights. But the idea is to create a single comprehensive location where you can get the broadest range of information on the field. The format of the slides for the day's presentation is a name of the thing that we're talking about, an informal definition, some examples, some information related to complexity, how hard it is to solve this problem, or whether it is solvable, or what are the issues. And then maybe, in a couple of cases, either a picture or some pseudocode example or something like that comes down at the bottom. There are a couple of important properties to think about in each of the classes of things I'm going to talk to you about today. First one is, they're not orthogonal, okay? They're not at right angles to each other. So these classes are interrelated in many cases, okay? It's not, in that sense, a very, very good classification scheme. It's only whatever I could do. And I look forward to people who can orthogonalize the space of information protection. And there are some people that have tried. I'm just trying to be comprehensive. There are synergistic effects, okay? That is, one thing might be closely related to another. One thing might enable another. One thing might prevent another. Okay, a simple example is a denial of services attack may prevent you from being able to leak information because you've denied services to the thing you were going to steal the information from. So there's synergism, and we're not going to talk much about the synergisms, but they're there. They're not very specific. Okay, hopefully each of these classes are a broad class. In fact, in many cases, they are potentially infinite-sized classes. Okay, so when you think about it, we're going to put up maybe 94 potentially infinitely large classes of attacks and 140 potentially infinitely large classes of defenses. And hopefully that characterizes the design space that we have to work with. Maybe it doesn't make you too overjoyed, but that's how it is. They're descriptive only. I mean, I'm just trying to talk about the things that happen and the things that we know how to do. No mathematical formulas, no deep theory in most cases. I'm not going to promise you that you can use this for anything useful, but I've used this for some very useful things. And it's, of course, incomplete eternally, and I'm anxious to have you help complete it by your input. And there are probably a lot of other things like that as well, but hopefully, most importantly, it is informative. So we're going to start with the attacks, and attacks might be a misnomer. Failure modes might be a better word for what we're talking about today. They're really means and methods by which information systems fail to provide integrity, availability, and or confidentiality. There are seats right up front if you... That's the best seat in the house. No, they're going to sit in the back there. The causes range from natural things to malicious human actors, and some of them are infinite. Some classes, for example, viruses have 10,000 plus, I guess 11,000 plus known examples. We know it's a potentially infinite class. We also have 11,000 specific examples. Some classes are almost in the theoretical domain. We know that you, or we believe that you can do this, but we can't cite any real-world examples. For whatever reason, maybe there are some, but we can't cite them. Maybe there are none. And there's, of course, lots and lots of overlap between these different things. And hopefully, well, it's not time for the coffee break yet, but it is time for the menu change. Let's see if I can... let's try this. Oh, come on, wake up. Got it. There we go. I just love computers. First, the things that I'll call attacks or things that can go wrong, if you will, start with an A and have numbers. The numbering is not in any particular order. It's in the order in which they were put into the list. If you want it alphabetized, you'd come to our website and it'll be in alphabetical order. Errors and omissions is the biggest thing that goes wrong. Everything from forgetting to eliminate default accounts and passwords when you install a system, that's an error, an omission. Incorrectly setting protections, typing in wrong data, which causes the missile to go the wrong way. Forgetting a minus sign, causing the airplane to flip over as it crosses the equator. This sort of error and omission. Anybody think of any really good errors and omissions they want to call out? Famous error and omission.
Resetting default passwords from the manufacturer.
Resetting the default password from the manufacturer. I mean, if you can't think of, say, 20 errors and omissions in your environment in the last month, it means you're not finding them, because they certainly happen. What?
Year 2000.
How's that for a big error and omission? and of course, there appears to be an unlimited. Finite but undoubted number of possible errors and omissions in general purpose systems. Maybe you can do better in some special purpose systems. Power failures. Basically electricity goes out and that's bad because all the information technology depends on it, not to mention health services and emergency care. And in fact, a lot of people end up dying if enough electricity goes out for long enough at the wrong time of year. Okay, I think there's a couple of famous cases. There are a number of people that died in the power grid problems in the western part of the United States last summer. But in the winter, I think there was a case where power failed in Chicago and maybe 100 people ended up dying one way or another as a side effect of that. Because, getting cold in their rooms or something couldn't start, or the gas kept coming when the flame was not there, and when they then relit it with a match, they blew themselves up or what have you. Some of the examples I have is a blackout of a small city in California in the 1990s due to an error in a telephone line assignment. That's an error and omission causing a power failure. U.S. power grid cascade failures. The rolling blackouts in the eastern U.S. in 1984 caused by the harsh winter. I don't know if you remember that, but they shut down the government because they had rolling blackouts that they had to sort of go from part of the city to part of the city, blacking them out because there wasn't enough total power available. These are, I'm sure the information systems had a great time with that. And it's not really that complex an issue to address in most cases, but the underlying causes might be somewhat more complex. Cable cuts. This is, a lot of people believe that cable cuts are the number one threat to computers, the backhoe disease. The basically disrupting communications is what is the worst thing, and maybe sometimes power, but normally it's communications that takes a hit from backhoes. In the late 80s, there was a cable hit that disrupted all 18 supposedly redundant internet connections into the northeastern United States. They were redundant, but they all went through the same fiber when they upgraded the infrastructure. They cut the fiber. Then there was one in New York City that took down the East Coast air traffic control for like more than 8 hours. You remember that one? That was fairly recent. And internationally severed communications line during the Gulf War. General issue of cable cutting is really pretty painful. And there are a lot of problems to solve to address it. There is a potential solution that works fairly well against non-malicious attacks that we'll talk about in defenses. Anybody have any famous cable cuts they want to bring up to us? Animals to fiber. They like it? It tastes good, is that?
Yeah.
So when you bury fiber in the desert, small animals think that fiber is better food than the alternatives in the desert.
And
what?
Over in the Gulf, during the Gulf War.
During the Gulf War.
45 days bombing the heck out of their communications, but their internet stayed up. They had to communicate to their front lines all the way through the Gulf War.
He says, during the Gulf War, they bombed out almost all the communications, but the internet remained up.
See, so they could. Saddam Hussein's internet.
Yes, the Sodom internet. Okay. Fire is, you know, on the list of natural stuff, but it's, you know, it's not only natural. You know, they call it fire when you shoot a missile at somebody. That's called fire one, you know. Torpedoes, that's part of fire. And then there's also maliciously caused fires, of course. And basically it causes physical damage and usually permanent and temporary faults. It requires emergency response. It disrupts operations in various ways. Emergency response, of course, creates its own problems we'll talk about. Examples include the very famous Chicago telephone substation fire in the late 80s. Anybody living in the Chicago area? Did you experience this piece of joy? Oh, you were fortunate enough to miss it. Well, how long did it take to get that? About a year before they restored telephone service to that section of Chicago because a substation burned up. Brush fires are commonly encountered around Los Angeles and San Francisco, and that creates all sorts of problems. Fortunately, I live a little bit further from that, but some of my... we'll get to floods later. And then, of course, fires resulting from military attacks. And it's not a real complicated one. Statistical models work fairly well. You know, if somebody's shooting at you, you're going to take some hits. Flood, of course, very common. We all know what a flood is. The Chicago flood was one of the least expected floods, I guess. This was because a lot of the infrastructure is at below lake level. But they figured the lake could never come in. Minor mistake. Midwestern United States has had a lot of flooding in recent years. And this has caused just massive disruption of information systems at tremendous cost. But of course, compared to the cost of replacing everything else, that's not been particularly noted. And then they're commonly associated with tsunamis and hurricanes, et cetera. And in fact, they're fairly easy to maliciously cause. But they're also fairly straightforward to address by a variety of techniques. Expensive techniques. Earth movement is no surprise to those of us in California. The Earth moves and statistical techniques work. Of course, there are some things associated. Let's see, not all Earth movement is caused by earthquakes. There are sinkholes caused by mines, for example, that take out stuff. There's earth movements. I think in the Gulf War, in fact, they had some of these sort of big bombs that they blew up above installations that caused substantial amounts of earth to move and the people that were hiding underneath it to be buried. And so there are all sorts of things you can do by moving earth. Solar flares. To my knowledge, I am unaware of any people that are able to intentionally create solar flares at this time. So this is probably one of those things that's statistically characterizable. In fact, certain times of year, somebody says, I got a way to do it, right? Yeah, EMP pulses are very similar to that, yes, from nuclear weapons. But I figure nuclear weapons are probably a separate category somewhere in there. But if I don't bring something up like that. Volcanoes, we all know what a volcano is. The ash messes up telecommunications. The hot stuff that goes all over the place burns anything in its way. I don't know if anybody has a wire that can withstand that. It also emits infrared as well as things all over the spectrum, so radio communications are messed up for some period of time. But volcanoes are pretty easy to avoid, except in the movies when you live in Los Angeles. Severe weather is not such a big problem if you live in Livermore, where the most severe weather is a gentle rainstorm wherein we just moved to Livermore recently, and there's what we will call a drizzle. We moved from the northeast. There was a drizzle. I mean, I was walking outside without a coat on, no hat, sort of driving with the car windows open, a little bit of water getting on me, so what? My wife goes into a store, to do some shopping, and some other lady is in line and says, is it bad out? My wife says, sort of pleasant as far as I can tell. And a little bit of wind and rain never bother anybody, but hurricanes and tornadoes and winter storms certainly cause a lot of damage and death and wipe out a lot of information systems. But again, statistical techniques work very well in understanding this. Static electricity builds up on surfaces. There are different things that cause static, anything from lightning bolts to dryness in the air and this sort of stuff. Rubber-soled shoes. Naturally, I have rubber-soled shoes on, so I can... One of the things people say is whenever I get near a computer, it fails. So I wear rubber-soled shoes and carry magnets with me. Maybe that couldn't be related. Another big problem that causes computer systems to fail is environmental control loss. And it's closely related to the environmental factors, but it's actually quite different. For example, air conditioning is critical to many computer installations, and especially if you have a lot of computers in a computer facility, when the air conditioning fails, everything goes. And there's, I guess, widely published stuff where you've got 5,000 computers dependent on one air conditioner, and the air conditioner fails because, some part dies. And in very big air conditioners, there aren't a lot of spare parts hanging around. So maybe you have to get it manufactured specially, and it's real expensive, so you don't want to have one in inventory just in case each part fails. So air conditioning failures are actually a very big problem. Same with heating. Although more so in the winter than the summer. Temperature cycling itself is damaging to systems. And in fact, you can induce temperature cycling in some cases and cause systems to fail prematurely. Smoke, dust, vibration, corrosion, gases, fumes, chemicals, these are all things that do physical stuff to computers to destroy them. In fact, one of my most shocking moments of my life, I was sitting in my house working on my computer, and the cleaning woman who was, I'm not supposed to use that word or somebody will attack me, right? Old movie references don't count for much anymore. There was a cleaning person in our house, and she was walking around with one of these spray cleaners, the little liquid, and she has her dust thing, and she's spraying around. She gets over to one of my disk drives, sprays into the front of it, starts to wipe it, my computer crashes. Oh, my God. She was a very nice lady, but I certainly hit the ceiling. Yes, she was. I'll never technically. Relocation turns out to be a fairly dangerous stuff for a variety of reasons. One thing is it causes physical harm to equipment because of vibrations and shaking and moving and unplugging and cables bend and break and connectors get pulled and manipulated and all these things go wrong. But also, when you move equipment, it exposes you to other physical attacks. That is, the mere fact that you're moving it from place to place represents an opportunity to attack it in various ways. And historical data gives you a lot about relocation if you have much relocation historical data. And it's pretty bad stuff, actually. System maintenance, it turns out, is a pretty serious threat to systems. Unfortunately, inadequate maintenance is also a threat to systems. But I cannot tell you how many times maintenance has created problems that never existed before. But also, maintenance is very often exploited by attackers, for example, to create forgeries, to break into equipment, exploit temporary openings in the systems to be created by the maintenance process. Accidental introduction of viruses is actually fairly common. Maintenance people come in, and there was one case where they were inspecting a printer and trying to fix a printer that was on a network. And they put in a disk that they had brought from somewhere else, from somebody else's printer, got the virus from there, stuck it into this printer's controlling computer to check out, to do the diagnostics. The diagnostics came out, they fixed the printer, they walked away, the virus remained. Turned out in this particular case, the it was fairly complicated, but the virus ended up infecting this entire area, but actually two sites that were interconnected to a tricky string of processes, and they thought that they were safe. A lot of historical data on that if you look enough for it. Testing stresses systems, okay? Induces periods of time when the systems operate differently than normal. There might be temporary or permanent unsafe configurations that result from testing. And if you don't, normally when you test, you need to get the configuration and then do your test and then restore the configuration, and almost nobody does that properly. Tiger teams very often, even if they fail to penetrate a system, might weaken it in the process, for example. I'm not a big fan of tiger teams. Most of the current analysis is fairly naive in this area. Inadequate maintenance results in failed components, which causes things to break. But also, for example, it's very common for space to be consumed over time by logs and audit trails. If you don't regularly maintain it and reduce the size of those things, that causes systems to fail. And then, of course, the audit mechanism to fail, which might be even worse, because when the audit mechanism isn't working, it creates other problems. So doing maintenance hurts and not doing maintenance hurts. They're both dangerous. We have Trojan horses, finally something that you is near and dear to all of you. Unintended components or operations are placed in hardware, software, firmware, or wetware. Okay, think about this. Trojan horses are not just in software. You can put a Trojan horse in firmware, it doesn't show up until the right illegal instruction is executed by the right program. You can put them into hardware, I think some people call it chipping. But basically, Trojan horses in hardware are very hard to stop. Okay? And you can induce them by getting into the delivery process. When people purchase things, you might find out how they purchase things and induce, change the chip during shipment to put in a processor that has some special feature that allows you to get in later. And, I mean, there are time bombs, user condition bombs, additional instructions in memory, operating system modifications, name overload on programs placed in the execution path. This is very common in Unix systems as well as now in DOS and Windows systems. Added or modified circuitry, false connections, false panels, these bank ATM machines that they'll stick in a mall somewhere and gather all the cards. That's a Trojan horse, right? That's a false panel, essentially. Radios placed in components, et cetera, et cetera. It's one of the best attacks, one of the oldest attacks, one of the most well-known attacks, and one of the hardest ones to stop. Anybody want to tell me about a thrilling Trojan horse they've encountered? No war stories? Well, by the end of the day, we'll have them. Dumpster diving. Now, my graphics are not as good as they might be, but this was the best I could do for dumpster diving. But she's diving into that dumpster. They basically, this is a specific name, but it's a more general class of examining waste products to find information. And there are all sorts of waste products. Electronic, electrical, magnetic, mechanical waste products, paper, plastic, tapes, you name it. In fact, it's not unusual for when a tape goes bad, almost everybody, when a tape goes bad, unless you're in a classified environment, just throws the tape out. Well, the tape may be bad, but there might be some little bad spot near the beginning. If you go and read the tape, with a reader that doesn't die the first time you try to read it, you get a backup of the entire thing, you know, everything in your environment, including maybe the password file and all the special modifications they've made and what their access controls are and the names of all their users and, you know, all sorts of useful information. Fictitious people. Basically, we're talking about false identities that are used to bypass controls, manage perception, or create other conditions amenable to attack. So it's not just people saying, hi, I'm Joe, give me the keys. There are all sorts of things you can do with perception management. Surveys are a very common technique now. People do surveys to get information from your organization. And so you have your spies and impersonators. Network personae are very common now. People, in fact, if you have a bad rep out on the internet and you want to fix it, what you do is you create about 15 fictitious people. You make outlines of their characters. You give them different email addresses. And you send mail from different places with different perspectives to the mailing list that you're on that support every statement that you make. See? And that even though there's only one person doing it, you seem awfully damn credible. Because every time somebody objects, somebody else out there who you rarely hear from comes up and says, exactly that thing happened at my company. And man, this guy saved me. So there's all sorts of things you can do with network personae because it's so easy to be so many people. You do have to keep track of your multiple personalities. That's normally done with a profile, right? You keep a profile sheet on each person, the words they're likely to use, how good their language skills are, and what kind of phrases they use, where they're from. Their network on like this, so that you can what kind of company they're at. And in fact, a lot of the time you create little empty personae and fill them in as you go, as you need them, and just make sure that you're not inconsistent. And if you get to where you can't use any of your existing ones, you just create another one. So more efficient than pre-creating them, you create them on the fly, just in time delivery of fictitious people. Fictional callers are very common. At the all.net site, we have copier repair tries to call very often. We don't have a copier. That's what we tell them. Hi, I'm from Copier Repair. Why don't you come and fix your copier? Oh, we don't have a copier. Click. Well, try that one. And fictional, we used to get a lot of fictional callers. We don't get so many fictional callers anymore. I think they've gone to other means. Maybe they've given up. Many other false and misleading identity-based methods. This is really a very complicated socio-political issue, and it's nowhere near being solved. But basically, I got a comment on my book. It was in one of the reviews for my Protection and Security and the Info Superhighway book that said that what your book does is try to manage the perceptions of our people to defend them against attacks. That was their view of what the book did. And I think that's a very interesting point. Essentially, against these sort of fictitious people, the best thing that I know of that you can do is have your people be immunized. But it's a human immune system, not a computer immune system. Although, of course, they work against computers, too. Protection, missetting, exploitation. Misset protections on files, directory systems, or components lets you do all sorts of stuff. And it's just not a simple matter. For example, there are some linear time algorithms for setting protection, if you can figure out what they are. But in an average, say, time-sharing system, a Unix box, or even nowadays a Windows 95 box, there's something like 1 million bits of protection state in those boxes. Okay? So how do you correctly set any misset bit? Set to a 1 should be a 0, set to a 0 should be a 1. Can potentially cause denial of services, corruption of information, or leakage of information. How do you set all those bits right? How do you translate what is right into all those millions of bits? It's a really hard problem. Has anybody encountered this? Anybody? Have anybody fixed it? Not quite yet, but they're working on it. One of my favorites, resource availability manipulation. This is where, denial of services is pretty easy against most systems and components nowadays. So what you do is you use denial of services attacks to manipulate the availability of resources and then cause things that they depend on to fail, for example. Email overflow, used to disrupt the operation of a system. We did some experiments that were published a couple years back where we went through a bunch of command and control computers owned by the military, U.S. military, that were on the internet. And we essentially demonstrated that you could take down 85% of them by just flooding them with email. Now, that particular problem, that specific set of problems has been addressed, but only on those specific machines. Almost any machine you can take down with email, including the machines of most people's attack systems. File handle consumption, for example, has been used to prevent audits from operating, even in trusted computing bases. So if you can prevent the audits from operating, then the intrusion detection, maybe that depends on the audits, doesn't work. So you can then guess passwords forever and they never catch you, never stop it. Okay? So there's all sorts of interdependencies within systems, and the total resources are not adequate because of the nature of the way they design them. Most systems are designed to work properly under 95 or 98 or 99% of maximum load. Okay? But not under 100% of maximum load. They're designed because it takes too many resources. Overloading observable network paths to force communication to be rerouted. Okay? You send a bunch of garbage through some communications path somebody's using that you can't read, causing them to go through another communications path where you can read, essentially redirecting their traffic remotely, again, by manipulating the availability of resources. Most of these result from the high cost of making worst-case resources available. And this is one of this is an example from DCAs where you subscribe. An attacker subscribes hundreds of mailing lists to some victim. Okay? So all these mailing lists are now subscribing this victim, and the victim's just getting tons and tons of email. I mean, the President of the United States got overflowed with emails. Of course, he didn't have to know about it. His systems administrator just had to get rid of 10 million pieces of email a day for a while. Then we have the hacking community calls it human engineering. The military community for a while called it perception management. Then somebody decided that you could not manage perception. They called it perception influence for about 6 weeks, and then that guy left, and then the next person said, management's fine with me. The point is, you cause people to believe things that forward your goal. And if you can't think of 100 examples from today's newspaper, you're not reading or not understanding what's there. Tricking a person into giving them their password or changing their password to a particular value for a period of time is fairly common. Talking your way into a facility is unbelievably common and unbelievably easy. Causing people to believe in religious doctrine in order to get them to behave as desired. Now, those of you that believe in the same religious doctrine as me realize that we've been talked into it too. This has been a security issue since the beginning of time, and I don't think it's going to change. Spoofing and masquerading is, anything where you create false or misleading information to fool somebody into granting access. For example, operator spoofing to trick the operator into giving away a password is another version also of perception management. I told you they're not orthogonal. There's the location spoofing, to trick a person or system into believing that you're from a false location. That's what forging an IP address is, for example. Spoofing a login screen to get users to provide user ID and password information. I did an experiment in the mid-80s where I logged in as my regular user ID to 50 terminals in a terminal room and ran a program that put up a login screen. And I got every user ID, every user that walked up, logged in, gave their password, it said, whatever the error message is for your password's no good, try again. They tried again and logged in. And I had their password, including the super user, all within about 4 hours. Right, so you do this at like 7 o'clock in the morning. By 9 o'clock in the morning, you have access to everything, which is why you need trusted channels. Email spoofing to forge email, and my goodness, email spoofing in today's internet is, I think, maybe 80% of my mail is now from forged IP, forged email addresses, trying to sell me, sex or drugs or rock and roll or you name it. They'll sell anything. I try to respond. Sometimes it's interesting, so I try to respond, but the return address never works. It really bugs me. I mean, at least because if you wanted to buy sex, you'd say, okay, give me something. And now you can't get it. You have to call their 800 number. It's no good. Or their 900 number, even worse. And of course, one of my favorites is time spoofing, to create false impressions of relative or absolute time. And there are all sorts of things you can do with spoofing times. Number 23, moving right along, infrastructure interference. This is where you interfere with infrastructure to disrupt services and or redirect activity. For example, you create an accident on a particular road at a particular time, causing a shipment of very valuable goods to go another direction, okay, and then you go and modify the contents, et cetera. So, and it's not a highway accident, one example, but of course you can do this to electrical power, deny services. You might modify domain name services to reroute information to come through your machine, okay? Or in fact, to reroute information, the path of information flows throughout the network. Or cutting a phone line, just to cut somebody's phone line. There's a couple internet service providers that were not too friendly in helping me track down attackers, and I figure one day I'm going to stop by their place and put them out of business for, you know, how long does it take to get the phone company to come around here? 4 days? Yeah, attack my system, will you? Unfortunately, it's very simple to disrupt infrastructure, and it's very, very hard to analyze infrastructure to understand the implications of every possible combination of disruption. And some combinations of disruptions may be wide-scale disastrous, may cause cascade failures. And it's very tricky, and nobody is able to currently analyze this at the level of complexity of infrastructure yet. Of course, infrastructure observation, for example, watching air ticketing information. Okay, the air transportation system is what we generally consider an infrastructure element. Suppose you watch the air ticketing information to see when particular people go to particular places and use that as an intelligence indicator. Oh, these guys are going to that meeting every month that they have. Hey, they skipped the meeting this month. Something is happening in their company that's different or unusual. Okay, or, you know, there's, and especially in military situations, this is very commonly used to, you know, when the press does this, actually. Forget military. The press does this all the time when a couple congressmen, when there's a potential war looming out there or some conflict, and the three key congressmen go over to the White House at 6 o'clock in the morning, all the newspapers say, oh, he's notifying Congress according to that law so he can start the attack this morning. Absolutely. How many pizzas delivered to the Pentagon at 11:30 at night? In fact, all this sort of intelligence information goes, operation security is about protecting this, but this, so you don't have to observe bits of information in wires. You can observe behavior of people and other aspects, and it's just maybe better in some cases. Tapping into a PBX system to record telephone conversations, watching passwords going over the internet, fairly popular activity. Unless you're using like cryptography or spread spectrum or something like that to defend, this is all too simple to accomplish and very, very difficult to detect. Insertion in transit is pretty interesting. For example, it's not unusual to add transactions to a transaction sequence. So there's a whole bunch of transactions happening, you just throw a few extra in. And unless the transaction system has some sort of coverage of that, you'll get your transactions along with everybody else's. Insert routing information packets to reroute information flow in networks. That works most of the time. Insert shipping address information to replace otherwise defaulted values. Okay, you know, bill to, ship to. If there's no ship to, use the bill to as a ship to. Gee, there is no ship to. I'll just add a little ship to, and it'll ship it to my temporarily rented with cash warehouse, where you will drop off your integrated circuit chips whose value is more than their weight in gold, literally, and I'll leave with them. I mean, so this is essentially corrupting information in an information system as a method to get something physical. So, you know, this is, there seems to be this widespread belief that this is a hard thing to do, but it's almost always technically straightforward. Complexity only arises when specific defensive measures are in place against this. Observation in transit telephone tapping, network tapping, I/O buffer watching. This is very similar to infrastructure observation, except it's not just in the infrastructure. We're going down a little bit. And again, unless they've used cryptography or something. So for example, I/O buffer watching is a very different sort of thing than infrastructure observation. This is something where within a computer you might watch the I/O buffers, which maybe are readable to everybody because their protection is the design of the way it works is such that they have to be protected so anybody can read them. This used to be the case in some versions of some operating systems and probably still is in some versions of some operating systems. So you watch the I/O buffers and you watch as people type stuff in, user IDs and passwords and these things. So you're observing, but not at the infrastructure level, actually within a machine, but in transit. Modification of information in transit. For example, removing end of session requests and providing suitable replies to insert yourself into a session to take it over. Very easy if you're on the same local area network. Much more difficult over a wide infrastructure. Modification of the amount of electronic funds transfer. I just changed the amount, no problem. If you do it at the right point, it works. If you do it after it's transmitted, it doesn't work because they have all their checks on it. But if you do it at the right point within a system, it's been approved, it's not yet been encoded to prevent it from being modified, now you make the change. Okay, that's rewriting web pages so as to reroute the subsequent traffic through the attacker. Okay, there's, I think, somebody, well, about a year or so. Yes, sir. It is. Well, you know what packet it's going to be. Do you interfere with the packet? Right? I mean, they're bits flowing over a wire. You have access to the wire. You just stick bits in to, for example, create noise, a clash in an Ethernet. You provide a packet clash, and then you replace it. There's another good example of this I wanted to bring out, but well, it'll probably come up somewhere later. Sympathetic vibration. Everybody knows what sympathetic vibration is? Yeah, some do. Good. It's a positive feedback to create oscillatory behavior. And if you do it in electrical systems, you get positive feedback. Eventually, you'll blow out transformers or blow up transistors or circuit breakers or what have you. So you can do it in electrical or acoustic wave enhancement. You can create packets in the internet that create infinite loops. Okay, a lot of the IP, some substantial parts of the IP protocol allow you to create positive feedback loops in the internet remotely. So you can take down chunks. Yes, sir. Yes. I mean, anything that's a wave phenomena, if you... the question was, do you think you could do it optically? And yes. Optical has different problems because of interferences with crossing waves. But you can't... And that's how lasers work, right? Light amplification, Yeah, okay. Yeah, good thought. Creation of packets on the internet, I mentioned.